Der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Juhu. Welcome to the Hurra Hurra Podcast. This is again an episode in English language. And before we go to the hot topic and talking with our guest, this time it's Vera Zarchetti, I make a few notes for you dear listeners. And it's like this, that this whole podcast is coming from the Burg Giebichenstein Kunsthochschule Halle, which is a art university in Germany. And we do this as a sort of, in a way, outreach, but also to discuss design education and the questions around it. My name is Christian Zöllner. I'm a professor at this university, and I do this more or less from my perspective and in a way of a network that that grew over the past years, also with the Hurra Hurra Festival, which we might come back on during this episode. But if you, as listeners, have any feedback or recommendations, who shall I talk to, who might bring in a new or very interesting perspective into the discussion on design education, send me an email or write a message on Instagram or wherever. The email address is hurrahurra@burg-halle.de. So if you're interested in whatever cooperation or want to say something ideally nice, then you're very welcome. If there is some harsh critique, also do not hesitate to send it over. And for this end of editor's note, I'm very happy to say hello to Vera Zarchetti, who is our guest today. And I hand over the word directly to Vera to introduce herself. Vera, the word is yours.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. It is a great pleasure to be invited to speak to you today. My name is Vera Zarchetti, and I am a Lisbon-born, Basel-based critic and curator. I work mostly in the realm of contemporary design, architecture, and creative practices. And over the course of the last years, I've been editing books, organizing exhibitions, programming events, large and small scale, and all of them are connected with topics that interest me, thankfully, but also hopefully are interesting for the contemporary moment that design as a discipline and architecture as a discipline are sort of experiencing. And usually they are connected with how design and the design discipline has to change. How can we push the boundaries of what we do? How can we collaborate differently? How can we learn differently? How can we reinvent the world around us, perhaps?
Perhaps, yeah, that's the question. To dive into the conversation, I want to cite yourself. So this is like weird because you hear yourself through me. Because in the book, Design is Learning, that that you published with a group of other people for the Istanbul Design Biennale, which you also co-curated. You write, I read now, this book, which is like the catalogue or the surrounding information gathering to this Biennale, is a starting point illuminating how the much-needed design shift the much-needed shift in the field of design and design education is already underway. This shift appears in many shapes and colors and opens several doors towards possible futures. It calls for greater responsibility and greater agency. It demands visibility and creates spaces for the opinions of others. It pushes design out of its silo and into the spaces where it connects with other disciplines. It insists on learning as a permanent embodied attitude, one that transcends the formal spatial and temporal boundaries of the school and overflows into the world and life itself. That is sounding very, very great and is like a mission statement, or should be a mission statement, for every teaching person in the design and art field. Do you have a good example where this is already happening?
I think that is an ambitious statement. Huh? Here it is. It's our cry for what the future should be looking like. And as with all ambitious statements and with all of those cries for what the future should be, it is something that we have to do ourselves now and in the future that is to come. What we formulated there was really an attitude that was the guiding attitude that oriented our research, our curatorial effort for the fourth Istanbul Design Biennial, which was called A School of Schools. It happened in 2018 in Turkey, in Istanbul. It was curated by Jan Bulun, Nadine Buota, and myself. And it tried to take a deep dive into what is design education, what is the status of design education right now, and at the time of the Bauhaus centennial, because it was the anniversary of the Bauhaus at the time, we started this biennial with the claim, 99 years after the Bauhaus, design education remains the same. And yet the discipline that we all practice in has completely changed. So does it make sense that we continue to learn design in the same way that 100 years ago it was being taught? So that was our starting point, right? And then what that led to was a very sort of deep dive into what is it that this means, learning, teaching. We should not be teaching. We should actually just be listening to each other. We should understand that learning is a constant process that overflows the boundaries of the school and goes into the streets, goes into every interaction that we have every day. And therefore, it is very much something that we are all a part of. And so therefore, it should not be something that we think we are consumers of, that can just sort of sit back and absorb, but it's something that we have to be part of, that we have to engage in, something that we have to do together. So I cannot tell you, here's a good example of how that is working out. I think that there were a lot of leads, a lot of clues in the projects that we included in the biennial, but I also think that it's more about changing the attitude, changing the perspective, changing your role and the level of engagement that you yourself have with the discipline, be it that you are a student or a teacher or a practitioner, that you take this attitude of constant doubt, questioning, what is there, what is predefined, and really try to get to the bottom of things, really try to have a critical spirit, really try to be inquisitive, to question, to open up and reform again, to be more interested about the way that things are done, to be more interested in how your power can really have an effect in the world. I feel like we've been numbed. We are all numb, you know, and what we tried to say there was, just wake up, snap out of it, like realize that you in fact have as much responsibility about the whole thing or about the state that things have arrived to as everybody else. And the only way that we're going to get out of this moment of crisis is if we just work together through it, together, think through it, act through it, find ways to come out of it or to change it or to transform the surroundings and yourself in the act of thinking through it and making through it and so on. So I can't say that it's a work that is finished because it's not. It's just barely begun, but I'm excited about what's gonna happen in the next years.
I wanted to keep on that track a bit because like what I'm really interested in and what I see as an educator as well is that in the design education, there's a focus on aesthetics. And aesthetics in not in just like glossy surfaces, that's not the thing that I mean, but the competence in addressing sensual, also embodied, I miss the words, but that we are enabled as designers to get to people through aesthetic feelings or aesthetics. And what you say, like the whole responsibility and being able to learn lifelong and stuff, that is super important. But isn't that just a question that is for all the disciplines, not only for design? And why is it so important to have that in design? Why do you take it to the design and not to the economists or to the social workers or agriculture?
I think it's a kind of transformation that mm-hmm. is happening over the across the board. No, it's I take it to design and to design discipline because this is the discipline where I'm a practitioner, where my agency lies. If I was an agriculture, mm-hmm. An agricultural expert, probably I would try to do, maybe not, who knows? That was a long time ago. I would have made many other different decisions in life, but I just feel like it is, you have to start where you are active, where you can. I think once you understand that you want to see this transformation happen around you, you just start where you can in the platforms that you have, you know. I feel like it is important to do it in design specifically. And so there are two things. Of course, I think it's something that needs to happen across the board. So in general, I think it is a transformation that is happening because the world is changing, because paradigms are shifting, because people are questioning a lot of things. So it's a transformation that is going to come whether we like it or not. So we either jump on that ship or we don't jump on that ship, and then the ship is just going to sail without mm-hmm. us. So I think it's a good idea to jump on it, so at least we see what comes next. But why it needs to happen in design also is because design is a discipline that for the last, let's say, 25 years, especially in the Western Europe and North American regions, has been undergoing an existential crisis for the last 25 years. Why? Because these were the places in which design traditionally is considered to have been born in, out of the Industrial Revolution, out of concerns that are connected to capitalism, to reproduction, to mass scale production and distribution, and so on. And those realities, we've understood, are not realities that are sustainable, interesting, or useful for the planet, and honestly for us either. So design has to change its field of action. I mean, of course, we're still going to be needing toothbrushes and, I don't know, bikes and stuff like that, but we have to think about what else can this discipline be doing, you know? And I myself believe that design has to claim for itself a completely different role, which is mm-hmm. a role of mediation, a role of connecting the dots, a role of helping perhaps other disciplines connect to each other. But here I use the word help, and I really should not, because design cannot help anything. It cannot solve anything by itself. It needs to collaborate, basically. It needs to listen, needs to find a way to insert itself in other disciplines. And I also feel like design needs to understand itself as a discipline that is fundamentally rooted in collaboration, is fundamentally curious and interested in collaborating across disciplines, so not just with designers, because otherwise we're just going to be talking to each other and it doesn't solve anything, but really trying to use the methods that you learn in a design education, perhaps, or in your design practice, or that are specific to this discipline, you can try and use them in more interesting ways, away from let's create an object, let's sell a toothbrush or something, you know? And I feel like that agency is something that is currently under exploration everywhere, especially in the North American and in the Western Europe regions, and is finding new ways to become a different discipline, actually. And suddenly we'll probably be seeing local variations of what this discipline can be. And if we continue to have the internet and we continue to share information the way that we have been sharing it in the last couple of decades, then we will really learn about new possibilities for this discipline. I don't talk about what is called the Global South here, because I think the so-called Global South has been able to leapfrog a lot of the questions that we are pushing in ourselves here in the Western Europe, North American regions into the discipline of design. I think these other areas have completely different histories of design that have not been appreciated, studied, or made public. And they have a richness and also a direction for the design disciplines in these regions that is going to be completely different from the ones that we are going to end up finding for the design discipline in the sort of Western Europe and North American regions. So I'm very curious about what that is going to be. This talks about a complex future with multiple histories, multiple design scenes, multiple design possibilities. And that makes me very curious, I would say.
You say that there are specifics to the discipline. And if it comes to interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary working that where I'm totally with you is what design is all about, to do things with others and to implement our specific skills. I would be interested what, in your words, are these very specific skills that come with the discipline as in design that we can contribute to all the not to all the others, but to certain other disciplines that we cooperate with. You know, that's because I'm just let you come up with something, because I have a question there that where I'm not sure if we talk about the same thing, like the specifics of the discipline. That I would, what are the design specifics of the discipline?
I would say that design is a discipline that deals with problem analysis or situation analysis, that deals with research, that reads with collaboration, that deals with coming up with translations of certain problematics that are exposed. So usually if you study nowadays, you have briefs, right? You have a problem, so-called problem in design school. I mean, I'm pretty much against solutionism and this sort of solutionist rhetoric, because I'm not sure that we can find solutions for anything really, but that's what's usually asked of you. No, you have a problem, you have a situation that you encounter, and you're asked to assess that situation, analyze the situation, and propose a translation of the situation to a certain other dimension. Is it a poster? Is it a book? Is it an object? Yeah. And sometimes when it's more complex and there's like more complex things involved, you are usually also asked to perhaps design a situation, perhaps design an interaction, perhaps design a digital environment, perhaps design a space, you know? So it's basically about offering ways to translate problematic situations into another language, but also to offer a solution with that translation, right? But because we are very solution oriented, we also have created a rhetoric in our own discipline that makes us as the designers think or assume that we know what we're doing. So this leads to big problems. Look, for example, my research for my master's thesis was all about social design. And social design in this particular case was, I was looking at North American designers that go to so-called developing countries with their solutionist approach, and they try to solve problems, so-called problems. But if you are a North American designer that grew up in New York City, has never set a foot in a slum in Africa, you cannot pretend to know what is the best solution for this context, because you do not know this context, you do not know the people that live there, you do not know the situation, you have not studied it. And also, you going there and presenting a solution just basically reveals a fundamental disregard that you yourself have for the people that live there, because you think you're superior to them, because you can go there, they don't have like a water system here, I need to like make some toilets for this slum. But if you would go and see how people have been managing waste problems or waste issues for the last 50 years, maybe you would be capable of actually proposing something that is maybe more culturally adequate or respects the situation in which these people find themselves, and so on. So something that started with, let's make a perfect chair with fantastic materials, great tubular aluminium or tubular steel chair that is in perfect balance and fantastic leather. So it started as kind of a material exploration of a simple problem, which is the problem of seating, can then end up being, let's make toilets for a slum in Nigeria, despite the fact that I've never been to Nigeria myself except for holidays. And I was very shocked that, you know, there are poor people in Nigeria and I want to help them, right? So this can very quickly get very problematic. I should also make a parenthesis to say that even the seating example can be very problematic, because for whom are we making this chair, and who is the ideal body, and is that ideal body male, middle-aged, and white? Question mark, no? Mm-hmm. So all of these issues have to be sort of, I feel like we need to take a step back and be like, okay, we were taught to believe in the last 100 years that the agency of the designer is infinite, that the designer is a hero, that the designer is a lone genius that can come up with the solutions for these problems. But we forgot to ask a couple of questions, which are mostly connected to you yourself as a designer will only be able to give your own personal solution to that problem. So you will only see the solution through the lens with which you look at the world. And on the other hand, you need to always consider your audience. Are you serving them or are you doing them a disservice? Who is your audience? Why do they need this thing that you are proposing to them? Is this even interesting? Maybe not. So my whole thing with this solutionist approach is really that we should be taking a step back and rather listening and trying to understand the field before we go and with our God complex pretend that we can fix and solve and offer solutions to things, because I think that that is not what design should be doing at all. It should really be about using these methodologies that are intrinsic to the discipline to bring about perhaps change or transformation or acupunctural interventions here and there that then will potentially change or translate a situation to a different thing. So yeah, that was a very long answer to your question, but hopefully.
Yeah, but it was a very, very good answer to that very, very stupid question. So that I'm very thankful on this point. There's so many interesting things in it, and in the German discourse, I don't know what the English expression is, but we call it Autorendesign, authorship design might be a good thing. Like, you know, these, as you, like Philipp Starck, for example, an industrial designer, is like one of those guys, just like formulating its inner genius through producing motorcycles, juicy juice dispensers,
just and you know
all that stuff, chairs and things.
So, I mean, but that has a lot to do with capitalism, no? Because the 90s and the late 80s brought about this idea of the designer as author. Now, the designer as author is this kind of like marketable thing that you can attach to your tap. And if you designed a Hans Grohe tap with Philipp Starck, you can sell it for $500 instead of 30, right? So that is another layer to the issue, which is, you know, you think that because you put the signature of Philipp Starck in the tap, you get some sort of like value that you can sell for and make more money with it. So this is all a very delicate issue that has to do more with capitalism than anything else, I would say.
Yes,
and designers love it.
It's such a glossy thing, and it was super reproduced by magazines, by websites, by all these like fairs, all that, like the big buzz.
Yeah, because there's a whole economy that depends on it. So it is productive and it makes a lot of money for a lot of people, the whole media industry, the fair industry, the designers, the producers, the distributors, the people that gain commissions out of selling those taps. I mean, by all means, we need taps. I'm not saying stop making taps. Taps are important, but
water-saving taps are important. And what I think is that from talking to you, and I get a bit goosebumps because I'm a bit angry about myself that I didn't know it before, but that emancipating from that idea of, as you say, the godlike author, the one that gives the solution, that one proposal that is going to be produced 1 million times all over the world and distributed in big containers on large ships just to bring the divine to everywhere is something that that is super necessary to explain to the students that this is not real anymore, and that this reality hasn't been. I mean, it was quite a big fun for these guys, but it's not working anymore because there is this little girl from Sweden saying it to us that this is not working anymore, and.
I mean, it's not just because of this little girl from Sweden. I'm happy she came about and did what she did, but it's, you know, it's just not sustainable. And again, this is about the ship. Like, the ship is sailing and we either go on it or we don't. You know, we can stay making taps and selling them for 500 euros and going to the Cologne Furniture Fair every year. And we can pretend that this is all still sustainable and makes sense. We can pretend that we can still produce a million taps and that they're not going to all end in some like dumpster in the middle of I don't know where, or thrown into the bottom of the sea, or burnt into a pile of trash somewhere. We can still pretend all of that, but it's not true. And the fact, I mean, and it's very uncomfortable to realize that it's not true, because it puts a great weight again on whom? On you, on yourself, because you yourself have to question those things and you have to change them. You have to change them first within yourself and then around you. And the moment you see it, it's like as if you pull the towel out of the table, and under the towel, there's all these crumbs and the table is super dirty, and you never saw it because you never, it just looks like I'm talking about some sort of epiphany or religious experience, but it really is like the moment that you understand that this is all a lie, and we have to stop encouraging that lie because that's only going to get us to a bad place. Everything becomes very clear, and it becomes very clear what you need to do. You need to dismantle it. You need to dismantle it. You need to change it actively every single day with your work as a student, as a professor, as a lecturer, as a curator, as a designer, as whatever. You need to change. You need to speak about these things. You need to put them into the conversation, and you need to change them. And you say, okay, but this is such a huge thing. How can I change it? How can I change it? It's so much bigger than me. Well, you have to start with you, your practice. What do you say yes to? Mm-hmm. What commissions you take? Who is paying for it? Are you still really working for that client that has some shady money business and you still get money from this person? You know, easier said than done, of course. But this is why it's a work that needs to be done every single day. And I think that the moment is ripe to understand that design is not about lone geniuses, because we have to understand that the only way we're going to get out of the mess that we've created for ourselves in this planet with this discipline is fundamentally change the way that we work, and we need to do it with each other. It's not just about me, it's about all of us working together to change things. It's about transdisciplinarity, it's about collaboration, it's about fundamentally working together, I think.
Yeah, totally. And you call that in an interview, you talk about the post-industrial paradigm. Is that the post-industrial paradigm that you talk about?
I mean, it's very interesting that you say that expression, because this was something that...
Is it paradigm? What is the real... How do you say it right?
The post-industrial paradigm. This is something that I started writing about and talking about, I think, in 2014. That was when I did also with Jan Boelen, the biennial, the Bio 50, which was the biennial of design in Ljubljana in 2014. And this was the first moment where actively I engaged in a project that was trying to question this, what we call the post-industrial paradigm, which was where, at the time, we were talking about how design is leaving this industrial paradigm and entering, and here again, we're talking about Western Europe and North American regions primarily, and design was entering this post-industrial phases, which is the phase in which it questions all those things. It questions, wait, the industrial model doesn't work anymore. Consumption ad infinitum doesn't work anymore. Production ad infinitum, distribution, sales, and so on. This all needs to be questioned. And what we did there at BO50 was we tried to change the way in which we can work, in which designers can work with each other, in which designers can work with other partners. So we put basically groups working together in this long 6 months process to see what would come out of it at the end, to see what could be maybe a new way to collaborate and what kind of results could come out of this, you know. And it was a series of briefs and or projects that were very connected with the territory, because that was another thing that is very interesting, and I think it's something that has to be crucial to whatever future understanding of design we want to have, is that you need to work A, with what's already there, so you don't necessarily need to create something new, and B, you need to look around you to see what are the issues around you that you perhaps could have an impact on. So in Ljubljana, this manifested in, you know, working with local partners, local companies that were experiencing certain local difficulties and so on. In a project like, for example, Atelier Yuma in Arles, this with whom I collaborated, and I was co-editing a book for them. It's a project that deals with exploring the potential of a bioregion in the south of France, and basically looking at what are the materials that are produced by this region, which is an impoverished region where there's a lot of unemployment and so on, and what can we do through the lens of design to give another kind of value to these materials? So can we use algae from this region to make something else? So one of the projects that is was done there by Studio Clarenbeck and Dross was they started trying to 3D print with algae, mm-hmm. with biomaterials, to try and create a biopolymer that then can be used for creating new kinds of containers that can even be containers for food, for example. No, so it's a completely different way of understanding a region and of understanding the resources of a region and trying to give them a different value through a design intervention. So here's another way in how design as a discipline and the design methodology, material analysis, translating a situation, collaborating with the local agents can give rise to something that is interesting and can be interesting and can be also economically interesting if we support it in the right way, basically.
And what is interesting here is that, thanks for talking also about the Ljubljana exhibition or biennial, and coming to that, because that is something that I see as a super, super important thing, is to get away from that idea of being an author and being an international known author, because that is also something that comes up with on which level you define yourself as successful in the past, you know. Okay, if your stuff is all over the place, but this is something very imperialistic in a way that is like, wow, it's me and everybody should really benefit from me, but as you say, working in on site, very regional, does not work if you live in a hot bus such as Brooklyn, Kreuzberg, St. Pauli, you know, like in these creative hotspots. This is something that is necessary to be on site in Vorarlberg
Or you can work in Kreuzberg or in Brooklyn. There's also problems in Brooklyn.
Yes, of course. But then you should address the local. Do you take it in account to do that too? Mm-hmm. And I was reading a book that it's called From Bauhaus to Bitterfeld. Bitterfeld is a city near Dessau and very, in the whole GDR, it was very coal centered and very very like high industry centered, and in this book it's from 1990 and it's about the design tradition in the GDR, like how did they design, because as you call it post-industrial paradigm, a lot of things that have been a practice back then are something familiar to now. So okay, we cannot use so many colors in that in the train interior because we should we do not have all these colors, and there is everything has to adopt to the color of the cushions because that's the only color we have, and that is so super interesting, and that they also did not just lived in Leipzig, Dresden, Halle, Magdeburg, wherever in the GDR, but in Sonneberg, in like super, super tiny villages, because there have been like in industries or some sort of like places where things have been produced, where they could impact or just at least work or bring their competence in. And that is something that I'm not conservative and looking like brightly back into that GDR, but it's something that I see is a massive need right now to bring the designers out of the urban centers into the periphery to impact there, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, one thing that is interesting about this Luma example or this Atelier Luma example is that the site that they use as the site of their explorations, which is Arles, it's a mid-sized city where a lot of people have left for bigger cities. And it's kind of it's kind of similar to a lot of other cities in the center of Europe. Like a lot of other cities are in that situation. They are impoverished. They are depopulated. People kind of forgot about them, but they are in fact the majority, because the big metropolis is not the majority, you know, and the big exodus to the cities is not, yes, it happened, but that does not mean that the cities became better places to live. It just means that they became more crowded and with perhaps less to offer to everyone. So I agree with you that we need to, but this is something that is very, very prevalent also in just other realms of thinking about design, just this whole idea of moving from the center to the peripheries, or to center the peripheries, in fact, as places where there's more opportunities, there are more possibilities, there's more to be found. But also we should, you know, again, with this, let's say, imperialist idea or this colonialist idea, we should be very careful, because it's not like the peripheries are now the new place where we're going to make money and, you know, exploit people and so on. Because I'm very critical of these kinds of participatory practices as well, because although I think that there lies a future for design in these kinds of practices, we always have to ask the question, who are you serving? Who is benefiting from your intervention? And if you go there and use a certain population as yours, let's say your testing ground, do they get something out of it? Because if they did not express the wish to have you there, if they did not express the wish to have a designer come find solutions for them, perhaps then maybe you could step back. If there is a wish that is expressed from all the stakeholders in the situation, because again, we cannot look at this as a situation where, again, the designer, as the author, as a genius is like, oh my God, we have to solve this issue in this place that is poor. We have to be careful about that. If there is a situation that presents itself where you have multiple stakeholders, where you have multiple sources of funding, where the designer is a piece in a network and not the most important agent in the whole project, then I think these are good starting points to start. And yes, I think we should focus our attention in the things that surround us, in the things that affect us, because that's also the more tangible and easier for you to see the impact of what you're involved in and so on. But I'm very critical of participatory practices that don't respect the wishes and the intentions of the other participants in the participatory practice. For example, one example that you can think of is an example that it was very much done by companies not that long ago. Like, for example, Nokia would go to countries in Southeast Asia or in Africa, and they would do these labs, you know, with kids being like, oh, let's study the future of the telephone. And they would ask kids to be like, can you design for us what you think would be the telephone of the future or whatever, right? And this would basically be market research that they would be doing for free under the guise of a cool workshop for these kids from some slum somewhere, right? And we have to be very careful about these kinds of things, because, and I think we are, you know, but again, the other thing too is that when you think about issues of the digital space, which at the moment is almost, it is as important as the real space, and there's no actual difference between the two anymore, because there is a certain agency that you can have in the digital space that you can also have in the real space or in the physical space, let's say, you have to think of issues of also digital poverty, because so-called digital poverty, I also don't like that expression very much, but there's places in the peripheries that are not as well connected to the internet, that don't have as many possibilities, that where you cannot have where people don't have iPhones all the time, you know. So this means that you also have to be very aware of this, and you have to be very careful, again, who is your audience, and what resources do you have? So you should not, you know, think that you can solve everything with an app, for example, because that is also not democratic at all, you know, to think like that.
That is very interesting, because what you say, that the designer is not the only or the center agent in the game or play, and that the importance of stepping back, listening and giving people the chance to be heard is something that is of course totally clear, but as you are saying it, and also with the emphasis of being bit angry, or just like, oh, not angry is the wrong word, excuse me, but vehement, or just like, okay, you, that's a point you want to make. It is also one thing that a lot of male persons should have or must have in the current discussion. You know, it's the point also when you talk about the authors, or when we talked about the authors, it's the point who is the guy who has to step back, and it's often that kind of like dude-ish people, you know, like, oh, yes, look, I'm here and I'm gonna solve you everything, and everybody is just audience, and yeah, you laugh, but it's something that even for me, because like I'm like, you know, like this great long, not great, but long white male person, and also for me it's a permanent process of stepping back. Sometimes I'm quite good at it, sometimes I just fail, but it's something that I'm aware of, and I have to learn and have to learn and have to learn and to give space. But and that is something that is maybe this is something that is super important right now to recognize privilege and to step back from it, to give space to others. And that I never thought about it in that like longer loop or bigger loop as you are doing it. And but when we but as we are here right now, and it's like we have 20 more minutes to go, I'm very interested in your work as Foreign Legion, because like when I just like talk about feminism a bit and like just like conquering the patriarch, I'm not like the male supremacy, what is it called, patriarchy.
There we go. Thank
you. Foreign Legion is a point that works on a feminist front in design, isn't it? Would you say
very
like
much
that?
So. Well, yeah, we try to call ourselves these days a curatorial initiative for systemic change, is what systemic we try to call ourselves. Mm-hmm. Systemic change means changing systems. So it's not necessarily, you know, even if our first project started trying to explore issues connected to the invisibility of female practitioners mm-hmm. in design, we have since understood that we need to make the discussion a little bit broader. And so we talk about systemic change, about changing systems. But maybe I go back and I explain a bit about the origin of mm-hmm. Foreign Legion. Foreign Legion is a curatorial initiative that I started with my dear friend and colleague, Matilda Krzykowski, a Polish-born German designer and curator. And we, at the time, found ourselves both to be in Basel, and we just started talking about this idea of how we were so tired as being women and being foreigners in Switzerland, working in the cultural industries. We were so tired of we always just felt that we had to do the thing 10 times better, 10 times louder, 10 times more than, you know, your typical male white Swiss person in the same position. And that basically was a frustration that we shared. And for me, things got worse once I had my daughter. Mm-hmm. I became a mom, and that basically apparently means to everybody except me that you are suddenly retarded, like your brain doesn't work properly anymore because you gave birth to a child. And this was a discovery. It was a discovery. And again, it's a little bit like the moment that I was talking about before. It's like when you take the towel away from the table and suddenly you see this whole underworld that was there and you're like, wow, what's going on? You know, but suddenly, because you had a child, you can even do less than before. And I didn't feel that way. So I was very frustrated that I was made to feel that way. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, like with any activism, you only really engage in it when it starts hurting you, right? And so Matilda and I shared a lot of meals and a lot of wine, and we were very much interested in defeating the patriarchy and complaining about this this fact. And what happened then is that she was interviewed by a magazine, and then, you know, famous last question in magazine profile interviews, what comes next for you? And she said, well, I just started this curatorial initiative with my friend and colleague, Vera Sacchetti. It's called Foreign Legion. Well, except that we hadn't really started it. We were having dinners about it, but I guess that you can say it started.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple months later, she gets a phone call from Tulga Bayerle, mm-hmm. who is now the director of the Museum for Kunst und Gewerbe in Hamburg. At the time, she was the director of the Dresden Kunstgewerbe Museum Dresden. And basically, she gets a call, which is like, oh, I heard you have this initiative now. It's called Foreign Agent. You're doing things around feminism, right? I would love to invite you to organize a symposium around this exhibition that I'm curating called Gegen die Unsichtbarkeit, Against Invisibility. And that's how Foreign Legion started. So a little bit of luck and a little bit of hard work, which is how I usually say everything needs to be made of. And basically what happened was that Foreign Legion started by doing this symposium, which was a complement to the exhibition Gegen die Unsichtbarkeit, where we looked at the mechanism that rendered women invisible in design 100 years ago and sort of explored, are they still active today? Spoiler alert, they are. They have not changed at all. And so we talked about those things. We talked about women that were written out of history because, you know, museums do not have good enough or detailed enough archival systems, and that means that the work of women usually gets archived with the work of their husbands, or for example, if a woman gets married, her name changes. So in fact, you are archiving the work of Maria Schmidt, Maria Klein, and Maria something else, but you don't know that they are all in fact the same person because this person married two times. Or for example, especially in Germany, given the situation around World War II, a lot of women just simply could not work anymore. You know, and they just were out of a job, so they could not continue to be practitioners because political ideologies brought them back to the home, and it was not a commonly accepted social role for a woman then to work. You know, or you know, you lost your husband in the war, and then you had to be the sort of caretaker of your family, and you could not have an independent practice as a designer, and so on. So those mechanisms now maybe are less strong. But what we really understood is that many other mechanisms, such as how are women inscribed in history, who writes the history, you know, you have Van de Velde famously saying that he did not think that a woman could think in three dimensions, right? She could only think in two dimensions. So when you have major architects and designers that publicly say these things, and you have major historians that will write about your work differently if you are a woman, then it's clear that your work is not going to be inscribed in history, right? So what do we need? We need to make space. We need to make space for more women, for more voices, for more opinions. There cannot be just one history of design. There have to be many histories of design. You have to give space to everyone. And so this symposium gave rise to an exhibition that we also did at the Kunstgewerbe Museum in Dresden called Add to the Cake, Changing the Roles of Female Practitioners. And this was trying to open up a new conversation about how is it that we can change the roles of female practitioners? How is it that we can add to the canon of design? And that is an effort that continues. We continue to work on this direction, and we really continue to think about how is it that we can continue to add to the canon. And this is why we started talking about systemic change in general, and not so much about women in design. Because also many times when we talk about women in design, we have to understand that A, we have to go beyond the gender binary. B, when we talk about women in design, we are mostly talking about white women, which is also a problem, a very big problem. And also we just need to open up the discourse to regions that are not Western Europe and North America. We need to hear from other places in the world. And therefore, we try to look at it in a more intersectional way and also look at issues of race, of class, of disability and ability, and try to question also those things. So this is why for us, it's important to open up the canon, especially open up the conversation. So yeah, it's a work that continues. And again, it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning. It's a work that is done every day, all day, all the time. It doesn't get easier, but also us, me and Matilda, we are very privileged to be able to do this work, because there's a lot of people that cannot do this work, mm-hmm. you know? So I feel like privilege, which is a very essential word that you touched upon at the beginning of your question, privilege is something that should be acknowledged, should be questioned. And again, we should make space. we should make space as much as we can. And this is, again, taking a step back, listening, opening up doors. You know, me as a woman, a white woman from the south of Europe in design, my goal is to open doors. And I want to open doors and keep them open for everyone else that comes after me. Because it is about making space. It is about opening doors. It is about creating new spaces for other perspectives, for multiplicity, for complexity, for what I love to call polyphonic understandings of what this discipline and its agency should be.
Yeah. Yeah, well said, well said. And but do you understand yourself as a constant co-working team, or is it more Vera's here, Matilda is there, and from time to time, if the occasion is right, you do things together?
If the stars align. Well, we try to keep in touch. And I think that these sort of very fluid configurations are also configurations that are very contemporary, mm-hmm. right? Like, I myself don't see myself as an author at all. I need to always work in collaboration, because I find that it's a much richer experience if we talk to each other. Like, for example, this conversation mm-hmm. is much more interesting than me talking to an audience and saying how the world is done. Because I do not like also this prescriptive attitude. It also goes back to the author, the god, the mm-hmm. genius. I'm like
dropping knowledge.
Exactly. I like to engage in conversations. And so this is why all the projects that I do, they are collaborations. They cannot be otherwise. And, you know, collaborations are like relationships, and relationships have to be nourished, right? If you don't call your friend 3 years, he's not going to call you back anymore, right? So it's like a plant. You have to water it, and you have to create some sort of continuity to these relationships. But I think that they are also very much organic things. So, you know, you do collaborations as long as they work out, and then when they don't work out anymore, you go on to the next big thing. I think the important thing is to keep conversations happening, to keep collaborations happening, to keep relationships alive, basically.
Yeah, as you say, I like the word nourishment, because it's a word that I don't use a lot. I don't translate it, but I coin it also with care. And having that is something that in my world or my like cosmos comes in more and more as a design goal. Or just when I think about the shift in design and design education, there was a focus on maximum convenience. You know, having a thing, having it as long as it lasts, and then throwing it away and getting a new one. There is no care involved. And I think in that, by doing so, by surrounding yourself with things that you do not care for, this is something that reflects back on yourself and also in the way you interact with other people. And that shapes you, the world, and that surrounds you shapes you back in a way. And that is something that I also have to say, like, and this is something that comes also in the conversations, like with you, that wow, fuck, I just went that way quite a lot of times, like, and I just became not became but recognized some very ignorant ways of acting and neglecting care as something that others do, you know, like even as a father of two children and partner of a wonderful woman, it's like something that I recognize through long discussions. And even I'm grown up as a young man and in a world there where care was outsourced and not outsourced, but I wasn't mm-hmm. the guy who cared. It was always the girls and the women who took care. And as you say, like, that is something that can be an end of a design process, that there is a system that should be cared for in a way. You know, that that the end of a design process is not a thing that is there and forever, and but something that has to be cared for, and that mm-hmm. also includes a lot of people, and they are not service agents to take care of that, but are contributors and contributors to that thing and own it in the same way. That is, sorry, mm-hmm. I just was like floating.
It's a very good point. I think you raise, again, you know, that goes back to this interdependence aspect that I was mm-hmm. trying to evoke before. Like, we all depend on each other. Like, the only way we're going to get to the next stage, wherever the next stage is with each other. So it starts with you changing your perspective, but it also means that you yourself have to understand that you only if you care for others and if you take care of the ones around you, only then can we get out of the mess that we're in. But then this also evokes a very interesting notion as well, which is the notion of maintenance, you know, maintaining things, right? So nourishing, maintaining, these are all things that we should be paying much more attention to nowadays. And I think it is becoming clearer and clearer, especially after this pandemic year, that these are the new things that, or not the new things, but the things that have always been there, but we just didn't pay enough attention to them, you know? And it's okay that we didn't, because the world was a different place. We had our attention somewhere else, you know? But now we're all experiencing a moment of very sort of harsh awakening in which we're mm-hmm. all being forced to understand that those should not be our priorities, you know? And I think that it is very interesting to focus on maintenance, to focus on the small scale, to focus on what's already there, which is something we were already talking about earlier today as well. So maintenance, care, working with what is there, and sort of taking a step back and engaging in a different kind of relationship with things. It's not about winning. It's not about success. This is an interesting thing that you said before, like what mm-hmm. makes a designer successful? It's really not about success. Those are not the markers that we should be looking at. Fundamentally, what I'm trying to say is that it's not about you. It's not about the individual. It's about we.
Yeah, but it was such a mantra. All the like last 20 years in my like design world is like, be successful, be the player, go there, get coverage in magazines, later in blogs, then social media.
So what happened to all those people? Like, they came to the age of 45, they had a midlife crisis and went to plant potatoes somewhere in the middle of the countryside, because that is not sustainable. That mm-hmm. is not sustainable, because the moment you are nourishing yourself, you are not nourishing your relationships to others. What happens when you get so successful? It's quite lonely at the top, actually. Nobody cares about you, you know? And there's a moment in life when you're like, actually, that's not what is important. You know, it's such a cliche. Look, I feel like I'm my therapist. You know what I mean? Yeah. It is, but it is, it is, it is. It's like this. It's like this. It's just like, it's, I don't know. It's like that moment when you realize that actually your parents were not always right. You know, that is the first thing. The second thing is when you understand that everything you learned in university was great, but actually the world doesn't work that way. And the third thing is, actually, it's not about me. It's not about me. Yeah. But you know, like, if you look at, it's just like such a human thing. If you look at a small person, a child, they're all about themselves. Like, the center of the universe is them, for them and for the people around them. They think they are the center of the universe. So it's a long process. I think that's just part of being human. It's a long mm-hmm. process of understanding that it's not about you, that you are not the center of the world. The world does not turn around you. News alert.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll just like make like buzzword notes, like post-pandemic priorities and decentering designers. So it's shit. Oh man, Vera, that's great. Time is running, and I have this one super interesting point that we cannot talk about. That's the driving the human project.
So exciting. Yes, I know. Well, we're going to launch an open call tomorrow, the 10th of February.
So this podcast will not be real. When is the end of the call?
9th of April.
Oh, perfect. So it will be right in the scene. And you can pitch it. Pitch the call.
I can pitch it. So Driving the Human is a project that is funded. It's a German project funded by the German Ministry of Environment. And it's connecting four German institutions, the Forecast Mentoring Platform in Berlin, the HFG Karlsruhe and the ZKM Karlsruhe, and AKATEC, which is the German Network for Scientists and Technologists, which is based in Munich. And together, they are doing a call, which starts now on the 10th of February, for new visions for eco-social renewal of the planet. So we are calling for ambitious ideas by collaborative teams that try to think about more sustainable ways of inhabiting the planet. And this can take any shape. This can be, you know, anything from designing an interaction to a prototype that you can inhabit, to something that it happens in the virtual space, to a set of guidelines or principles for a new way of living in the planet. It needs to be ambitious, it needs to be serious, and it will basically be encouraged and nourished until the end of 2022 from an idea to an actual prototype that can be experienced and basically reproduced then, and it's something that can then be actually enacted in the world. So you can always just Google this thing. It's on drivingthehuman.com,
and it will be in the show notes as well. So
fantastic. So you can see it in the show notes. Check it out and please apply, because we want great ideas. So we want you, ambitious person, fantastic thinker, listener as well, very important. We want you.
Oh, wow. Vera, this is amazing. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Great conversation.
Very, very, very nice to talk to you. Yeah. I'm very happy to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it leaves me thinking. It's that's what I also really like on these podcasts, that because of these pandemic times and being surrounded by young humans thinking the center is the universe all the day and night time, it's great to have these like very good talks. The podcast is also for you, dear listeners, but to be honest, I like to talk to all my guests as well, so it's there's a benefit for me as well. So anything to say from yourself, because like last words belong to the guest.
Ooh, last words. Guys, my last words to you are, be generous with yourselves and with the world and with those around you. Those are my last words.
Der Design-Podcast der Burg.